Good morning. I'm Paul Solman. Welcome to Weekonomics, our Friday roundup, and welcome to Simon Johnson of MIT and the Peterson Institute and formerly the IMF. Morning, Simon.
Nice to see you, Paul.
All right, so this is a lightning round. We're going to go through the week's topics or some of them as quickly as we can. First one, I was jolted to read your baseline scenario post today where you claim that the Nobel Prize was given to the International Institute of Finance for requiring no capital from banks at all.
That's my understanding. I have to check the date carefully on this sort of announcement, of course, Paul. But I think they actually won two Nobel Prizes for economics and the Peace Prize for their contributions to international banking and to facilitating the cooperation between regulators and the banks they're supposed to be regulating.
Well, this was extremely unsettling because I wasn't really fully awake yet. I read this morning, and only when I read the comments did I realize this was an April Fool's post. But what were you trying to get across here very quickly?
The Institute for International Finance is a lobby group for the world's biggest banks. They put out a report that was widely cited as being serious in news last year, saying that raising capital requirements for the biggest banks will be bad for the broader economy. It's not true, Paul. It's absolutely false. It is fabricated. It is junk research. It's not research. It's just pure lobbying. But somehow we take these lobby groups far too seriously. So I thought I'd take the opportunity today to try and promote them a little bit.
but a reasonable week to do it. And this is a week that in the New York Times, Neil Barofsky, who was running or was overseeing, looking at monitoring the TARP program, had a blistering op-ed after he left, I'm going to quote briefly, about Treasury. Treasury provided the money to banks with no effective policy or effort to compel the extension of credit, no strings attached, no requirement or even incentive to increase lending to home buyers, not even a request that banks report how they use TARP funds. Indeed, and he ended with this, Treasury's mismanagement of TARP and its disregard for TARP's Main Street goals, whether born of incompetence, timidity, or a mindset too closely aligned with the banks, which you've been arguing the whole time, right, may have so damaged the credibility of the government as a whole that future policymakers may be politically unable to take the necessary steps to save the system the next time a crisis arises. My goodness.
I think, honestly, Paul, there's a growing consensus from well-informed people like Barofsky. Sheila Baer at the FDIC doesn't use those exact words. She's much more diplomatic, but this is very much where she's pushing. You see it from other top regulators. Jerry Corrigan, the former president of the New York Fed, who's now at Goldman Sachs, is saying on the record, he said it in a magazine interview this week, that all the measures that he and his colleagues were saying would work in terms of making the system more stable, like a so-called resolution authority, are not going to work. So they've changed their positions, and everyone's agreeing that we face the potential of another calamity, particularly if we don't insist on much higher capital requirements for systemically important financial institutions known as the big banks to you and me.
But the stock market has been going up. The banks' profits are going up. The bank stocks are going up. So it looks like so far, if I'd been betting on your predictions, I would have lost money.
Look, you have to, you and everybody has to go look at the webpage of a Professor Anat Admati at Stanford Business School. She and her colleagues, and she's got almost all the big independent guns in finance behind her, pick apart this whole game that we've constructed around too big to fail. And the key point there, Paul, is that the kinds of subsidies, implicit government subsidies you provide to big banks, are good for the people running the banks, but they're also good for shareholders in those banks. They get more of the upside when things go well, and they get downside protection when things go badly. But who do they get the downside protection from? They get it from you, and they get it from me, they get it from taxpayers, and they get it from everybody who's lost their job. 8 million jobs lost, Paul, since December 2007. What kind of safety net is that for a few thousand overprivileged, overpaid, extremely arrogant, incompetent people?
All right. But let's go to unemployment now, because the report just came out minutes ago, 14 minutes ago, and doesn't look bad. More than 200,000 jobs created. People thought if there'd be less than that, that would be bad because it wouldn't keep up with the growth in population and so forth. But according to two surveys now, and one is the payroll survey, and that has more than 200,000 jobs created. The other survey, where they go around and talk to people in their households, the household survey, there also some job growth. Unemployment rate down to 8.8%, although I should point out that that our number, U7, we have a most inclusive of all number, which is just all people looking for a job. That number, I haven't done the percentages yet, but the raw number actually went up in March.
And the headline unemployment number, 8.8%, remains about the same. The key point, Paul, is at this stage in an economic recovery, a hopeful economic recovery, output and employment should be rising much faster. If you compare job losses, change in employment from before the crisis with all other post-war recessions, this experience, the last 2 to 3 years, is totally different. This is not a post-war, standard post-war recession recovery pattern. It's actually much closer to what the U.S. experienced before 1907, before the modern monetary system was created. A mini depression of the 19th century fashion, where employment went down 6%, we lost 6% of jobs, and we're still down, roughly speaking, slightly more than 5% from previous peak employment, and we are struggling to come back to that previous peak employment. This is a long, hard slog. It is not at all the miracle, magical recovery that we hoped for and that people in the financial sector will sometimes try and tell you that we're getting.
Well, but you, when we talked about this a few years ago, we were talking about what kind of shape of the recovery. Was it going to be a V shape? Was it going to be a U shape? Was it going to be, you said, bathtub? Was it going to be a bathtub shape? That is a long, low bottom. In terms of the stock market, it's been pretty much V-shaped, right? In terms of GDP output, not so much, maybe U-shaped. In terms of employment or unemployment, yes, bathtub shaped. So sort of a mixed picture, no?
Mixed, unless you're unemployed, Paul, in which case it's the bathtub. And remember, the bathtub has slippery sides. That's the point of that metaphor. Metaphor, by the way, which I drew directly from when I was quoting the Bank of England back when we talked previously. And I think the Bank of England has got this exactly right. We've built a financial system that can blow up repeatedly. Every time we go down, we'll take this massive hit to employment. We'll struggle to come back. We'll build up, for sure, a lot more risk in the financial sector. That's what these big global banks are doing right now. That's what they're being encouraged to do by our own Treasury Secretary. He wants them to go global. He wants them to build bigger balance sheets based on bets in emerging markets. And Citigroup, run by Vikram Pandit, is saying, yes, let's do it. Jamie Dimon, JP Morgan Chase, is saying he's already doing it. Doesn't make any sense. These banks will blow themselves up. And next time we may have found ourselves close to the situation of Ireland today, this week, also in the news, in terms of the damaging bank losses there that have devastated the fiscal balance sheet of the Irish state and pushed them into the arms of the IMF and pushed them into a very deep recessional depression. And I don't know when the Irish are coming out of that one.
So let's talk just briefly about, we only have a minute or two left here, Europe, Portugal this week, the government resigns, the socialist government, because it was pushing for austerity, and austerity was not passed by the Portuguese parliament. Ireland, as you say, the rates at which these places have to borrow has gone way up. The cost of insuring against default has gone way up in those places again, up to their historic highs. Is Europe about to blow up?
No, I think this is actually the end of the beginning of the transitional phase for the Eurozone. The Portuguese will have to come into the IMF for a program that's been obvious for some time, and the resignation of the government makes that easier. It doesn't make it pleasant for the Portuguese, don't get me wrong. And I think the Spanish have done enough with regard to their cajas, the relatively small regional banks with very problematic governance structures. They've done enough to stabilize the situation there. And I think the Eurozone will move on to a deeper restructuring phase. They still have a big problem. Their central bank has a massive contradiction at the center of it. They're providing big subsidies to banks on the one side and to irresponsible governments on the other side. That's the Greek situation. They have to change the governance. They have to change the decision-making structure if they want to remain a serious regional economy and one of the world's reserve currencies.
But they're not blowing up. So there you're reassuring. I have two more questions. One, is Japan blowing up? I mean, literally it kind of did, or at least the northern part. But is this going to be a tremendously devastating blow to Japan? And then I have one question after that.
Well, it's obviously a devastating blow in human terms and an absolute tragedy. Beyond words, beyond description. In economic terms, though, I think this kind of disruption is something that you can overcome. I think a country with the resilience and the character of Japan will bounce back from this. But there are obviously many lessons to be learned, both with regard to natural disasters and with regard to energy policy.
Well, It reminds me of your bank point, which is if you don't operate with high capital requirements, you have very little margin to work with. Same thing if you're not taking all the precautions necessary with a nuclear plant, yes?
Multiple fail-safes, I think, Paul, is the lesson I draw from the financial crisis and from other natural disasters. And just because, and I've heard people say that what happened in Japan was regarded as a 1 in 10,000 years or 1 in 100,000 years event. I remember in August 2007, realizing we were in deep trouble when a quantitative analyst at one of the big banks was on the record as saying, our models are good except for events that happen once every 10,000 years. And we just had three of those events this week.
All right, great. Well, Simon Johnson, thanks very much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.